We spent 3 weeks laying down an introduction, not going to go over that material again, other than what we get here in the first three verses, actually the first verse. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, that's not Amos, Amoz is different than the prophet Amos, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Now, I guess there's three things I want to point out from this verse. Number one is the first thing, the visions which he saw, the process by which Isaiah was given this material is not unusual, is it? In Hebrews 1 at verse 1, what does the writer say there? God, who after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways. There are many ways that the prophets got their message. Here Isaiah says, which I saw. What does that remarkably remind you of, say, in the New Testament? John. The book of Revelation was all a series of visions. But so was the book of Zechariah, at least the first six or seven chapters, a series of night visions, six chapters. Seven and eight deal with something different, but the first six chapters was a series of night visions. Ezekiel was taken in a vision from Babylon over to Jerusalem, and he saw in that vision what was going on. He wasn't there again. Actually, but he saw. Anyway, one of the ways that God spoke was through visions. Now, I don't know if those were waking visions or whether they were dreams at night. I suspect both. Okay, so that's a way that the Bible came into existence. God spoke in visions, among other things. And when did Isaiah prophesy? We covered that. Remind me. Let me simplify the question. Were the 10 tribes of Israel still standing, or had they already gone into captivity when Isaiah prophesied?
Still standing.
They were still standing.
740.
It's going to be 100 years before. 100 years before the Babylonians begin their predominance. And so Israel is still standing. But notice there's not a mention here of Israel. If it were Israel, it would say Samaria, or no, it would say Israel and Samaria. And what is Samaria to Israel? Capital city. Instead, he says Judah and Jerusalem. And so Jerusalem is capital city, headquarters city, yeah, whatever you want to call it, of Judah. So that kind of interesting in the timing of the thing that this vision came while Assyria was still the dominant force and Israel was still the more powerful nation than Judah. Yet it's concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And I think you'll see why here in just a minute. Have you ever heard of New Samaria? But you've heard of New Jerusalem.
Right.
See the point I'm making? So we're focusing in on Judah and Jerusalem. Judah was the tribe of David, okay? Also, therefore, the tribe of the offspring of David, who plays a very prominent role in the book of Isaiah. Hint, the son, to us, a son is given, and the servant. So, you've got that going on. And Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, becomes the focal point, just like the old Jerusalem was, where the temple was. It's the focal point of man and God in harmony and in fellowship. Okay, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of the king, those kings. And we've already established the book of Second Kings and Second Chronicles as the base for reading about those kings and what was going on during their reign. You look at those, and they weren't all good kings, were they? Now, Uzziah was good and then not so good, and Ahaz was wretched, and Hezekiah was great. So we had ups and downs of the kings. What happens when a king is down? I mean, departing from the ways of God, ways of David, his father. What happens in the nation? Yeah. You don't know whether it's the influence of society that makes the king do what he does, or if it's the power of the king that leads the society. I suspect both, or they play into each other. Anyway, not all good, some really wretched. I want to tell you this. Rumor has it. Now, who was Hezekiah's son? Manasseh. Isaiah, this grand prophet, is the grandest prophet of all, except perhaps Moses, in Israel's history. Powerful, righteous man. Worked with Hezekiah to preserve the nation when they're being surrounded or about to be surrounded by that massive Assyrian army. Rumor has it, Jewish tradition has it, that in Hebrews 11 there was some were sawn asunder. Tradition has it that Manasseh had Isaiah, and he would have been an old, old man, in a hollow log, and using a saw, cut the log in half, and therefore also Isaiah. That's just an indication of how depraved the society in which Isaiah was working. That'll give us a bit of a flavor then as we go through. What's it say next in verse 2? Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for Yahweh speaks. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its manger. Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Look at verse 2. Listen, O heavens, hear, O earth. Right there, second verse in the book, a grand theme is introduced. Heavens and earth, heavens and earth, heavens and earth. And when we get over to, say, chapter 65 and 66, what's he call it there? New heavens and earth. And so I don't take this to be the globe and its atmosphere. I take this to be the relationship between God and his people, heaven and earth. You know what Josephus called the temple, don't you? Josephus called the temple heaven and earth. Why would he call it that? God, heaven, met man, earth. And that's what temples were, a connection point. And so I take heavens and earth as a call to this covenantal relationship between God and his people, which was symbolized by the temple. I'm going to talk to you, he says. I have reared sons and brought them up. Now, what Isaiah is putting his finger on here is every parent's nightmare. I have reared sons, I have brought them. What does it cost to rear a son? Bring a son into the world, bring a child, and bring them up to the point where they're independent and can go their own. What does it cost a parent? A lot of sacrifice. A lot of gray hairs. A lot of love. The sacrifice of love. Bring this child to the point. But they have revolted against me. I'm going to read you something out of Hosea, who was contemporary with Isaiah. Hosea, I think it's 13, but it might be 12. Okay. Flipping over here to Hosea 12. Hmm. No, it's 11, Hosea 11. When Israel was a youth, verse 1, I loved him. Out of Egypt, I called my son. You get the picture? Coming out, Moses, and or was it Jesus coming out of Egypt? Or was it the children of God leaving the Egypt, the captivity of the bondage of the law? Okay. Out of Egypt, I called my son. The more they called them, the more they went from them, from the prophets. The more the prophets called, the more Israel fled from the prophets. They kept sacrificing to the Baals, kept burning incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. How many of us remember taking them? Not you, Mel, but Candy, taking it, putting your finger down and letting your child learn how to walk while they held on to you for balance. And God says, that's the way I was to this nation. We come back here to Isaiah. So connect that Hosea 11:3 with this Isaiah. I have sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. Like I said, the parent's greatest heartbreak. See a child whom they've raised and loved to follow Jesus, turn away from following Jesus. They've revolted against me. An ox knows its owner. A donkey its master's manger. I want to talk about those two images. Ox knows its owner. You see the loyalty and the recognition. But what is the ox, the owner? Source of power. Source of productivity, plow the field, thresh the grain. Master cares and tends for it, protects it. It's like a covenantal relationship illustrated by a dumb animal. An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger. What happens in a manger other than Jesus being born? That's where they get fed. I provide for you, and a donkey knows that. An ox knows that, and a donkey knows that. But Israel doesn't know. My people do not understand. What's that passage over Hosea? My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. My people don't know. So here, God is laying out the premise of this book. I was like a father, trained them, provided for them. Even the dumb animals are loyal to their owners, but my people don't know. Alas, and now we're looking here at verse 4. Alas, sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who act corruptly. They have abandoned Yahweh. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him. Tell me about the word alas. Does yours say alas? Somebody, first word in verse 4. Alas, alas. Pardon?
It's Isaiah.
Yeah, Isaiah 1:4, first word, alas. Huh. Oh, sinful nation, what?
People weighed down with guilt.
Okay, huh. All right. The idea of, oh no. I mean, it's like you throw up your hands and there's, what can I do? You know, in Romans chapter 1, three times, it says, when they decided not to have God in their knowledge, what's the next phrase? He gave them over to the consequence of that decision. He did not force them to follow him. He called to them, but he didn't force them. And so this, alas, could indicate letting people have the consequence of their ways, even though it broke his heart, it was the right thing to do.
Final, frustrated, watching the hands clean of almost like your patience is done. So, all right, alas, let's.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I think it's more than just your patience is up. There's nothing left you can do.
Right.
You've done everything you know how to do. to make it different and leave free will in play. And they don't want it. So what else is there to do?
Well, the sign of frustration.
Frustration. I don't want to say despair, but grief. Grief. I know what's going to happen to you. I've tried to avert what's going to happen to you. You didn't want my ways. It's going to happen to you. Okay. Sinful people weighed down with iniquity. Boy, won't that preach? That people get themselves bogged into doing it their own way and not God's way, and they just find themselves kind of like, what was I trying to think? The more that you do a thing, the heavier it becomes, and finally it stops you. Like tractor pulling. That's something big in the Midwest. The further you go, the heavier the sled gets, and finally your wheels are just spinning. Weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, like father, like son. Sons who act corruptly, they have, now here's the key. They have abandoned Yahweh. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him. Abandoned, despised him, turned away from him. Does it sound like anything you know? Have you ever watched any of the Charlie Kirk clips on YouTube? New people who have abandoned God, despise him, and turn away from his ways. In a lot of ways, what Isaiah is talking to is prevalent in our society. Now, he's talking to them in a corrupt society with the promise that Messiah would come and rescue them, as we'll see going through this book. But that rescue has already taken place, but people still have the ability to say no to God. And I say it in my work on campus, that everybody in the world makes a choice regarding Jesus. Most of them, uneducated, uninformed choice, choose to do life their way in God. I mean, you can't say that the name Jesus isn't out there in almost every culture. How important is it to make an informed choice? And that's why I go on campus, to reach people when they're making life choices, at the first point in their life when they are independently making their life choice. It's a good place to be. But remember those three things there in that verse. They have abandoned Yahweh. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him. There's a lot of danger in a life and then in a society that takes that path. Now, 5-9, here's the desolate land that is given up on God, upon his ways, thinking that maybe by worshiping an idol, they'll get their crop, but they certainly will get their lust fulfilled by worshiping an idol. So God says, where will you be stricken again? What does that make you think? Well, let me read the whole thing. Where will you be stricken again? You continue in rebellion. The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there's nothing sound in it. Bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not bandaged nor softened with oil. Where will you be stricken again? What does that make you think?
No place left.
There's no place left to get beat.
Yeah.
Wounds that, how does the proverb say that? Scour away evil. Wounds it to something that, but you get the idea. The intent of beating a slave or whipping a son in their culture was to get them to regret what they'd done that brought that about. So where will you be stricken? It implies that I have beat you at every place possible to beat you. And he's not talking about individuals. He's talking about the nation. What else? Well, What I'm obviously referring to here, and you probably went there in your mind already, is Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and the curses. And starting in, I think it's 14, but might be verse 15, he says, but if you do not keep this covenant, then this will happen. And if that doesn't bring you back, I will punish you seven times for your sins, and this will happen. And then this will happen. And about six different times, he says, here's what's going to happen. And about the last time is you're going to be eating your own children. What else is there to do? Where else can I beat you? What more is there that's going to happen to you that might bring you back? See? And so he says, the whole head is sick. The whole heart is faint. Any thoughts on that? The head and the heart.
Rod?
Knowledge and their passions are all corrupt.
Knowledge and passions are knowledge desires. And desires or focus or vision or intent. Yeah, all those things that come from the heart. Michael?
I was just going to say it gives you a vision of chastisement, of trying to get your child to change and doing everything that you can to bring them back to a repentance.
Yeah. Well, we're looking at this phrase, the whole head is sick. The whole heart is faint. So the head is sick. What kind of information is running around and making your decisions in your head? And how strong is your resolve to follow a good decision? See, you don't have a strong heart when you're living in a corrupt society, even if you got the right knowledge, what's going to happen to you? If you don't have a strong heart, you're gonna go with the flow rather than stand like a rock. Yeah.
Sounds like society in Noah's day.
Sounds like many societies which God had to bring judgment upon. Sounds like, anyway. From the sole of the foot, even to the head, there's nothing sound in it. So if you view the nation of Israel as a body, he's not talking about individuals here. Tell about the nation as a whole, but the nation as a whole is made up of its individuals. By the way, on that point, you ought to see Hosea 2, where the wife represents the nation of Israel married to God, but the children represent the individuals of that relationship. Well, the nation is the individuals as a whole, and the children are the individuals individually. So you got both of those going on here. But here he says, you, from the sole of the foot even to the head, there's nothing sound in. Now, it might be looking at the lowliest person in society all the way up to the leadership, the sole to the head. That might be a way to see that phrase. He says, nothing sound. Are they not making noises? Nothing sound in it? There's no Puget Sound there?
Physically
sound, solid, not rotten. Opposite of a piece of wood, it's either sound or rotten, right? A house is sound or it's dilapidated structure, okay? Nothing sound in it. Bruises, welts, raw wounds. What are those? Bruises, welts, raw wounds. Deuteronomy 28, the curses have come upon you, okay? And he says, raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, nor softened with oil. What's the picture there?
No medical attention.
No medical attention. You don't care that you've been beat. They just, well, yeah, that happened. First, the God who made that happen. Sorry, that didn't look right. That's supposed to be a clenched fist. Curse the God that made that happen.
You need some oil on that.
Yeah. Isn't that part of the blessing to be, you know, bandaged, pressed out, and softened with oil?
Oh, yeah. It's addressing the wounds. Why is this happening? It's because I'm not certain. So it's addressing the picture. See, is a physical picture that conjures up how I address the thing that's bringing these wounds upon me. Your land is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your fields, strangers are devouring them in your presence. It is desolation as overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is like a shelter in a vineyard, like a watchman's hut in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. Unless Yahweh of hosts had left us a few survivors, we would be like Sodom. We would be like Gomorrah. Okay, so your land is desolate. Why is the land desolate? Here, cities are burned with fire. Why are cities burned with fire? Because God sent invasions, invading armies. The Philistines, the Edomites, the Elamites, the surrounding nations coming in. Your fields, strangers are devouring them in your presence. What's that? You remember Gideon? What was happening in the days of Gideon? Who would?
The Moabites or Ammon would raid them they'd let them harvest.
They'd let them harvest and start threshing and then come and wait till the work was done and then appropriate the crop for themselves. Strangers are devouring your crops in your presence. And it's a desolation as overthrown by strangers. Why in the world would that happen to this people? You go back to Deuteronomy 28 or Leviticus 26, the blessings and the curses. If you keep my law, my covenant, bless, 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 bless. And nobody can invade. One of you will chase 10 of them. Nobody. But if you don't, and you really ought to appeal to those two passages, you ought to make that just primal in your mind. Why would God let this happen to his people? Because they agreed to this covenant. If we keep it, you'll bless us. If we don't, you will punish us for the purpose of bringing us back to you. But if it doesn't bring us back to you, Deuteronomy 28, you'll scatter us to the wind.
It's interesting in those with Deuteronomy that it's stages too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Start with this. If that doesn't work, I'll go here.
Mm-hmm.
He gives them like 5 steps.
Yeah.
It's not like he just all of a sudden just dumps on them.
And that's parallel to a phrase that I think you'll read repeatedly in the book of Jeremiah. I sent them prophets, rising early and sending. Now, New American Standard butchers that and says time and again. But the idea is I rose up early. When I saw the departure coming, I sent them prophets, rising early and sending.
Trying to turn them.
Working with the, obviously, the curses. See what's happening? Come on back. So God didn't abandon the people until they completely gave up on him. But notice what it says. It says in verse 8, the daughter of Zion, code word for what? Jerusalem. Jerusalem. The daughter of Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard or a watchman's hut in a cucumber field. What's the picture that comes to your mind when you see that? Have you ever seen
a big, beautiful city?
Have you ever seen the shack where you might have lunch or take a break when you're in out in one of the fields? I mean, this place used to be covered with sharecrop or truck farming, and there'd be a little wooden shack where you could sit and take a break or have your lunch. It wasn't a magnificent thing. It was just a shack, a shanty. So is this
a shanty to save you out of the heat of the sun and to give you a break?
It could. But how does that compare with the temple that Solomon built? He says, that's what Jerusalem was like now. Just this shanty. Just this dilapidated, squalid hut. And then he says, like a besieged city. And verse 9, unless Yahweh of hosts, what's of hosts? Yahweh of hosts. that or originator of Hostess Cupcakes?
Armies.
Have a party?
Host. Armies.
Armies, multitudes, the magnificent armies of Yahweh. He's the one in charge of the armies, including the army that's going to invade you, by the way. Unless Yahweh of hosts, the one who's in charge of the world's armies, including his angelic armies, had left us a few survivors. Mary, what's another word for survivors? Mary?
Remnant.
Remnant.
Yeah. Remnant.
Remnant, that part that remains. Unless he had done that for us, we would be like Sodom and like Gomorrah. What happened to Sodom and Gomorrah? Totally devastated, totally eliminated,
raised
and lowered at the same time.
No remnant.
Raised like a razor blade. No remnant. If God hadn't left us a remnant, as despicable as we are, we would be like Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, that's interesting, because in the book of Revelation, in chapter 11, where was Jesus crucified? Egypt, that city which is mystically called Egypt and Sodom, where also their Lord was crucified. Where was the Lord crucified? But mystically, it's called Egypt and Sodom. What's Egypt? Captivity. What's Sodom? Debauchery. That's what Jerusalem was when they crucified Jesus. Okay? If God hadn't left us a remnant, we'd be like that. We'd be like that. But what's interesting then is this next passage. Okay? Let's read down through verse 15. Hear the word of Yahweh, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What are your multiplied sacrifices to me, says Yahweh? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and of the fat of fed cattle, and I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath are the calling of assemblies. I cannot endure iniquity and the solemn assembly. I hate your new moons and your appointed feast. They have become a burden to me, and I am weary of bearing. So when you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are covered with blood. Whoa, is that powerful stuff? Now, as we went through there, multiplied sacrifices, the offerings of rams, the fat of fed cattle, the blood of bulls, goats, free will offerings, the solemn assembly, the new moon, the appointed feast. Where did they come from? Every one of them was instituted in Exodus and Leviticus. Every one of them. So God says, I cannot endure the iniquity and the solemn assembly. What's he saying?
A very, very corrupt society that is not honoring God and is just putting sacrifices out there, and the blood is flowing, and but there's no connection with God for it.
If there's no connection with God, why are they sacrificing? I mean, sacrifice means sacrifice, shedding the blood of their animals.
It's polluted.
Still doing the acts.
They're doing the actions
without the heart.
Without the heart. Actions without. Yeah, exactly. A passage that I want to parallel with this, Jeremiah 7, where Jeremiah, which is 100 years, but take a look what Jeremiah says about this, the attitude of the people. The attitude of the people. He says in Verse 1, the word that came to Jeremiah from Yahweh saying, stand in the gate of Yahweh's house and proclaim this word. So he's right there in the gate of the temple. Hear the word of Yahweh, all you of Judah, who enter by these gates to worship Yahweh. So they're coming to worship. This is 100 years later. Okay? Thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel. Amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place, i.e., I won't kick you out. Do not trust in deceptive words saying, this is the temple of Yahweh. The temple of Yahweh. The temple of Yahweh. Hey, we're worshiping the God of that, the only God that there is. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly practice justice between a man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the alien, the orphan, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, nor walk after other gods to your own ruin, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers. Behold, you are trusting in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, sacrifice to Baal, and walk after other gods that you have not known? Then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered. You see the emptiness? Go out and live however you want to live, and then come say so many Hail Marys, or come do your penance, or come do this, and then go out and live however you want again. That's what Jeremiah condemned, and that's what Isaiah was condemning here. And look at God's attitude. I've had enough, he said there in verse 11. I've had enough of that. He says, I take no pleasure. Well, I'm offering the blood. It's not pleasing me. It's not pleasing me. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5, I have as my ambition to be pleasing to him. I want to please God with what I do. God says, I take no pleasure in what you're doing because you're doing it, as Mike says, without heart. Who requires, and he calls their presence in his temple a what? A trampling of my courts. Who told you to come in here and trample my courts? And that's all he saw it as. Your worthless offer. An abomination to me. I cannot endure. Look at these things of how God is looking at, but what were they to? How were they seeing what they were doing? This will get us off the hook. This will pay our penance for our sins. This will appease God. I've given the blood of this goat lamb here, and he'll overlook my adultery and my cheating. And I'll go out and commit adultery and cheat again. Then I'll offer some more blood and he'll overlook it. What you're looking at is, what am I trying to say? The attitude that they carried toward God. This is what they thought of God. He's just a sugar daddy. He's just, well, I'll get him off my back. I'll just get him off my back. Not like, and I really love what Scott says so frequently. That even if there were no benefit to me at all, he is still worthy of my adoration just because of who he is. They're looking at him as a sugar daddy. Get him off my back and I can keep living the life I want to live. And he says, when you spread out your hands, what does that make you think of? Now, I know the New American Standard says in prayer, and that's undoubtedly what it is. But what does that make you think of? Anything that made you think that the temple was a place where people could spread out their hands toward God? Solomon's prayer. Where is that?
Maybe. First Kings.
Yeah, Kings 8, I think. Dedication of the temple in his prayer. Also the book of Daniel. In chapter 6, Daniel in the lion's den, where it was a sin, it was a capital offense to pray to any god except for 30 days. And Daniel would open his windows and spread out his hands toward Jerusalem. And so this idea of that's my temple, that would be a posture that they would adopt. He says, when you do that, I'm not going to listen. I'll hide. Now, this is the dead giveaway. I'll hide my eyes from you. when God responded to Solomon in First Kings 9, he said, my name will be there, my eyes and my heart will be there. When they do that, I'll see them. God, when you do that, I'll hide my eyes. It is not a magic formula. It is a heart reaching out to God. And that's what they weren't doing. Because I multiply them, I won't listen because your hands are covered with blood. Can you imagine going to God? You got the blood of innocent people on your hands. Oh, Lord, you're so good. I think, look at your hands. Clean your hands before you come to me.
Amazing. Father looking at his son and so depraved that you have to turn your face away from them because it's so evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be, I mean, it's hard to even fathom that kind of pain. To me,
in the heart of God, yeah. And you, this is really a great point, Mike. And you see that exhibited in the darkness of the cross, where God turned away even from his own son, because he's taken upon himself all of this sin. There's a father turning in heartbreak from his own son. And so he says, your hands are covered with blood, so wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil from my sight. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, reprove the ruthless, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. What did James say with pure religion undefiled before God and the Father was? Visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction and keep oneself unspotted from. I mean, it's not a new message. God living, man living before God, the covenant in which we live and the forgiveness that's offered through Jesus, that's the difference. But the behavior of man, this is what God looked for from the get-go. This love, this generally, this sacrifice, cease to do evil, learn to do good. Now, evil comes naturally. Solomon, foolishness can be defined as, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to listen to my own counsel. I'm not going to listen to anybody else. I'm just going to do it my way. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child. The rod of discipline drives it far from him. Foolishness is there. We're all born wanting our way. Why is it that we don't look at our wristwatch and say, Mom's sound asleep and it's only 2 o'clock and I might be hungry and wet, but I'll wait till she wakes up. Why does the baby just cry? Because that's what's in its heart to do. It's there from the get-go and it has to be removed by parental oversight somewhere along the way. Okay, so he says, cease, quit now. And learn to do good. Learn to do good. How are you going to learn to do good? Look back here. In verse
God's
3.
Word.
Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Hosea said, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Learn to do good. What's the right thing to do? God will teach us that. In chapter 2. All nations have come to the mountain of God to learn to walk in his ways. Okay? Learn to do good. And I think what follows, and this is what's good. Seek justice. What's justice?
Balance
the scales. Yeah. Do what is, even if it costs you. Do justice. Reprove the ruthless. Oh, it's none of my, that's not my affair. Those guys are having, reprove the ruthless. Hey, it's not right, buddy. You need to do it God's way. God shows us how to live with people and how to treat people and how to respond to people. You need to learn that. Reprove us. Defend the orphan. So what would happen to an orphan? Sold into slavery? Bondage?
Abused?
And abused, defend that one. Step in the gap. Be to that person what God would be to that person. Okay? Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow. That's what you need to do. When you read that, that tells you what wasn't happening in that society, doesn't it? Widows were being taken advantage of. Orphans were being taken advantage of. Ruthless were getting away with it. Justice was not maintained. Nobody was stepping in the gap. I just learned to do my own business and keep quiet and not stand up and say, that's wrong. God needs people who are willing to stand up and say, that's wrong. This is not the way to treat people. This is not the way to build a sustainable society. Come now, let's reason together, says Yahweh. Though your sins are as scarlet, they will be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they will be like wool. If you consent and obey, you will eat the best of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you will be devoured by the sword. Truly the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. Let's reason together. What happens when you reason together?
Yes, you
do. What happens when you don't reason together?
You're in a dialogue.
Well, that's where Isaiah was, in a dialogue. Well, bad pun. What happens when you don't reason together?
More. Evil things.
Right. Passions take over.
Passions take over. You get censored. You get shut down. You get kicked off media.
Next door.
Because we don't want to talk about, we disagree with you, but don't want to talk about it. And so shut you off. When you shut off dialogue, you shut off communication, there's no chance of change. It's only through dialogue that you can reason with somebody and maybe the mind change. I want to share with you a thought from Paul, 2 Corinthians 10. Here in 2 Corinthians 10 said, verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, now he's not talking about the sinful nature. He's just talking about being in a body, having the emotions, lust, all of them. We do not war according to it. We don't fight our battles the way the flesh would dictate, because the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful. So I don't depend upon my logic, my wisdom, my philosophy of life, my limited, very limited understanding of the way things are. No, my weapons are divinely powerful to destroy fortresses. What's a fortress? It's the idea or ideology or philosophy of life that somebody does not want to give up. That's what it is. It's not some brick building somewhere. It's that thing in which I hide. I don't want to talk with you anymore about that. Ever heard that? Yeah. They don't want to let anything out. They don't want to give up what they're thinking. And if your thoughts come in, they have to deal with them. So they just, that's a fortress. Okay. And think about this. Think about this, Mel. What we have from God is divinely powerful to overcome that. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God and taking captive every thought to the obedience of Christ. Come now, let us reason together, he says. There's reason to that reasoning can allow errant thoughts to be corrected. What's the difference between the people in Thessalonica and the people in Berea. What's the difference between those two? Acts 17. Well,
one Berea, one study.
What happened when Paul preached in Thessalonica? How long did he preach there? Three Sabbaths. And then they chased him out of town. Why? Because he's preaching that Jesus was their Messiah and they didn't want to hear it. He went to Berea, which maybe 12, 14 miles away, I forget exactly, not that far, on the major road, would have had the Jewish synagogue in Berea would have had the same understanding that the one in Thessalonica. But when they heard Paul, they did two things that Thessalonica didn't do. They listened carefully. I want to understand what you said. I was thinking about this very thing today. I don't care if you agree with me, but I want you to understand what it is I'm saying. Oftentimes, as soon as you say something that people object to, you say, oh, we shut you off and say, I disagree with that. But do you understand how I got there? You know, Mike, there is no way you can lead a person away from what he believes unless you follow how he got there and lead him back. So the first thing that Thessalonica, Berea did is that they listened carefully to what Paul was presenting. What was the second thing? They examined the scriptures every day.
They reasoned.
To see whether or not it was correct. Right? What does verse 12 say, Acts 17, 12? Many of them therefore believe. Now there's your formula. You open your mind to new thoughts. That grant that that person is a reasonable person, a God-fearing person, and one who understands how he got where he got. I asked a friend of mine one time regarding preterism or regarding eschatology, covenant eschatology, that is that the last days in the Bible were referring to the last days of the Old Testament covenant with Moses, firmly. Friend of mine, long time friend of mine, he and I were talking about the differences that came up there. I said, I thought you thought I was a good Bible student. And he said, I did up until the day, and he named the day and the hour that he heard a report that I was looking at last days differently than him. At that point, he said, I used to think you're a good Bible student, but I don't anymore. And there was no discussion. It was just, he refused to hear why. He didn't refuse to. We just never did. We always put it off. To hear why I got to where I got to on that. Okay. When God says, let's reason together. Come now, let's reason together. That involves sometimes exploring thoughts that are foreign to you. Hadn't thought of that. Or anathema to you. Oh, you're a heretic. Ever been called a heretic? Right. Yes. Oh, you're a heretic. On what basis? Because you disagree with the groupthink. Come now, let's reason together. Ain't no way to get on the same page unless we reason together, because we're all on a different page from God in some aspect of our life. In our understanding, not in our devotion. Okay? Please differentiate there. Your sins could be as scarlet or as red, and I will make them white. What do you make out of that statement? Though your sins are scarlet, they will be white as snow. Though they're red like crimson, they'll be like wool. What do you make out of that statement?
Cleansing.
Cleansing. Do you take ability? You take want to? I mean, what does God want to do for this people? What does God want to do for any man? Wants to clean him up. He said, I can't stand you coming to me with bloody hands, but I want to call you. You have to participate. You have to reason with me. Open your mind, open your heart, and reason with your God. And if you do, if you consent and obey, stand. But if you refuse and you rebel, you'll be devoured by the truly the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. You put a peg on that one right there. The mouth of Yahweh. You're going to be blessed by me. You're going to be cursed by me. I want to take you to Deuteronomy 28 as we close. Deuteronomy 28, he says in verse 1, now it shall be. Now, get the setting. The plains of Moab, directly across the Jordan River from Jericho. They're about ready to go up, and Joshua does this. They're about ready to go up and conquer Jericho, enter the land. But they haven't entered the land, but they're on the verge of it. Now it shall be, if you will diligently listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, being careful to do all his commandment, which I'm commanding you today, Yahweh your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and then all these blessings shall come upon you. You can read down through verse 14. But look at 15 now. But it shall come about, if you will not listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, to observe all his commandment and his statutes, which I charge you today, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. And you go through the rest of the chapter. The chapter has them being scattered like dust to the wind as they don't follow. Look at verse 55. 54. The man who is refined and delicate among you shall be horrible toward his brother and toward the wife he cherishes, toward the rest of his children who remain, so that he will not give one of them any of the flesh of his children which he shall eat. I'm going to eat my baby and I'm not going to share. How do you get that far down? See? Because you choose to refuse God. How do you get the blessings? Because you choose to honor God. And so we come back here to Isaiah 1, verse 15 and 19. If you consent and obey, you'll be blessed and eat the best of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you will be devoured by the sword. Is that a clear choice, Mel? Listen to God and eat the best of the land. Refuse to listen to God and be devoured. And that word devoured, eaten. You can eat the best of the land or you can be eaten by the sword. Your choice. Clearly spoken. And then he says, truly the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. That's just an impressive closing thought there. You can count on it because he says, I said it. Now I'm going to read just one little bit out of chapter 9. This is the chapter to us. A child is born, a son is given. And all the wonderful things would happen when that child comes. And then verse 7, the last line, the zeal of Yahweh of hosts will accomplish this. And we get that message throughout Isaiah. I said it. I'm going to get it done. I spoke through my messengers. I fulfilled their word. My zeal will happen. The rain does not fall to this earth without feeding the plants that it was directed to. And so my word will sprout too. Trust it. If God said it, it's going to happen. Any thoughts?